This is Artworks, the weekly podcast from the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Josephine Reed.
Well, hi, everyone. I'm Ethan Hurd, co-artistic director and producer of Heartbeat Opera. I co-founded Heartbeat with Louisa Prosky 7 years ago. We're in our seventh season, and we're based in New York City. And we create radical adaptations of classic operas, as well as innovating new operas and new works. And we want to reach a contemporary American audience. We want to expand the audience for opera and make it accessible and fun for younger people and for folks who might normally feel intimidated by opera or think it's not for them. And we've done that by being in intimate spaces in New York, both in Brooklyn and Manhattan, typically spaces that are under 200 seats. And yeah, you know, more and more over the years, we've focused on making adaptations that speak to the here and now really powerfully, we hope, like a Black Lives Matter Fidelio or a production of Puccini's Madama Butterfly that looks at the whole story through the eyes of the biracial son. So that's a taste of what we're up to.
I first heard about Heartbeat Opera in the beginning of the pandemic, during an interview with Peter Zepp, co-founder of the New York Opera Alliance. He sent me a link to their virtual and virtuoso performance of Make Our Garden Grow, where 24 singers, 5 instrumentalists, and 3 dancers, each working in his or her own quarantine space, nonetheless came together via Zoom and made glorious music. That's just a taste. And if you haven't heard it, stop listening to the podcast and go to YouTube, search for Heartbeat Opera and Make Our Garden Grow. This performance really helped me get through the past year, and it introduced me to Heartbeat Opera, a small company that, as you heard, reimagines classic work in particular and opera in general for the 21st century. Since then, I've seen a number of their online productions and have walked away impressed by their talent, imagination, and their commitment to engagement on all levels. But I have to admit, also a little baffled about how Heartbeat Opera actually came into being. I mean, how do you start an opera company? That's what I asked co-founder and co-artistic director Ethan Hurd. I wanted him to recount that conversation with Louisa Prosky that led to Heartbeat Opera.
Well, we went to an opera at BAM. And I won't tell you what opera it was, but we actually left at intermission. We were fed up. And we went to have dinner and Aperol spritzes. And we started talking about directing opera and our hunger, you know, for opportunity as young artists. And we thought, okay, well, maybe we should make our own opportunity happen. And we talked about, you know, making opera more alive, especially for people of our generation and younger people. We really saw the potential, but felt like big, expensive opera by more traditional companies was sort of laden with unnecessary hierarchy and compartmentalization and really some bad habits, you know, some bad exclusionary practices. And Heartbeat was born. And, you know, we didn't know everything at the start. We were fumbling in the dark a little bit. But gradually, by making work and collaborating with other people and having the audience reflect back to us what we were doing well and what they were responding to, you know, I think our mission started to come more into focus.
Before you go on, what's the structure of Heartbeat Opera? Do you have a company? Who are the members?
Yeah,
who absolutely. Are all of you who work together?
Well, it really has been a core team of four of us over the 7 years, with other dear collaborators coming in and out of our orbit. But Louisa and I are stage directors. We met at Yale School of Drama, and we are the co-artistic directors. And then Dan Schlossberg and Jacob Ashworth are our co-music directors. Jacob is a violinist. Dan is a pianist and a composer. So it's been the four of us at the core. And then we've also had a producing director and now a managing director, Annie Middleton, and some support staff. But we are the core team. And then we work with a wonderful community of artist colleagues, instrumentalists, singers, designers, managers, and technicians. The thing I think I feel most proud of having created Heartbeat is the community that has started to really be a devoted group of artists and audience.
We think of opera as something that's very staid, that's very calcified, which means that we often don't get the utter astonishment and excitement that this music once brought and has the power to bring again. I mean, you know, we return to Puccini for a reason.
Right.
So I want you to talk about some of the ways you reconfigure opera so that that power gets resuscitated.
Yeah, you know, we approach it from various angles. One tenet of it is that we want to express our deep reverence for these works, these masterpieces, and with a healthy dose of irreverence. So we approach it with love and with the idea that a true masterpiece of the operatic canon wants to be wrestled with. You know, that we are honoring Beethoven by making sure that Fidelio speaks to the social justice situation of our day. So that's one thing. Dan Schlossberg is also a really brilliant arranger. And so what's become a calling card of our productions is Dan's rearrangements of the scores. So we've been distilling these grand opera orchestras down to usually a 7-piece instrumental arrangement that often incorporates unusual sounds, so electric guitar or accordion or some instruments that you might not have expected, jazz saxophone and Carmen, for example. And the hope is that when the audience hears the score in a Heartbeat version, they're really hearing almost a world premiere of it and hearing it fresh. And then, of course, there's the drama. There's the storytelling. We often do new English translations, not only of the supertitles, but of dialogue, if there's dialogue in the show. And we also cut and rearrange the libretto. So I mentioned our Butterfly. We actually started our version with Act Two. So we met Cho-Cho-San first before Pinkerton. And then the wedding day was actually a series of flashbacks for Cho-Cho-San. Or in Louisa's Lucia, we meet a woman who is in a mental institution of some kind, and she hears the overture of Lucia on the radio and then actually enters a dreamscape and relives the opera of Lucia. So those are some of the techniques we use to make the story fresh. And as I mentioned, we're in intimate spaces. So we really believe that part of the thrill of going to the opera is feeling the vibration of the music, you know, on your skin, in your bones. And we really feel like while it's beautiful to be in a large space like the Metropolitan Opera, and that has great value as well, being in an intimate space with opera is a really special experience.
No, I agree. It's like you're surrounded by sound in any small setting, I think.
Absolutely.
You mentioned Fidelio, which Beethoven wrote as an opera about a woman who tries to free her husband who's falsely imprisoned. And you reframed this into a story about Black Lives Matter. Tell me about this.
Yeah, absolutely. We decided to produce Fidelio back in 2017. And I knew I wanted Florestan to be a Black Lives Matter activist who is wrongfully incarcerated by a white supremacist prison warden. And we wanted to feature a primarily Black cast. And we also wondered, could we reach out to prison choirs and invite them to collaborate with us? And over the course of weeks and months, we gradually put together a really beautiful network of 6 prison choirs across the Midwest in four states, men's choirs and women's choirs, who agreed to learn the iconic Prisoner's Chorus, which comes right at the center of Fidelio. And I would say the production changed my life, and it changed really the course of Heartbeat. So Dan, my music director, and I got to visit four of the choirs in Iowa, Ohio, and Kansas. And being in those correctional facilities with those incarcerated singers and the outside volunteer singers who come in to sing with the incarcerated folks, it really just changed our perspective on what not only Fidelio is about, but what the meaning of freedom is, what the meaning of harmonizing together as a community, telling stories, singing, making music together. And I think it really grounded us and continues to ground us in the importance of what great opera can do and be in society. So in a way, it is our compass, certainly my compass.
And the Prisoner's Chorus in Fidelio in itself is just rips your heart out. But then when you're listening to choirs from prisons sing it, it's such a moving experience. Explain the way you used it in the play itself.
Right. So we were performing at Baruch Performing Arts Center in Manhattan, and the theater itself actually has a kind of concrete design to it. So we actually exposed most of the concrete in the space and we're projecting onto a big back wall throughout the production. At the beginning of the Prisoner's Chorus, we had our Leonora, who we called Leah, go to four corners of the stage and unlock the cell doors to let the incarcerated people into the courtyard for a breath of fresh air. And when she went to each cell door, light poured through the door as she swung it open. And we started to hear the voices of incarcerated singers through those four doors. And eventually the sound of more than 100 singers singing together, layered from six different recordings, filled the theater. On the back wall, we saw documentary footage that I actually shot myself of the four choirs we were able to visit in a kind of collage, a music video, you might say, with captions that very boldly say, you know, this is the East Hill Singers from Lansing Correctional Facility in Kansas. So it was a meta experience for the audience where they, you know, first of all, realize, okay, there's not an actual chorus coming on stage to sing in person, but there are incarcerated singers who are part of this project who recorded this audio track and then this video and are currently incarcerated in America. And it was, I think, more powerful emotionally than any of us could have anticipated. And part of that experience also was that we did a letter exchange with many of the singers. So we were able to share their letters, often handwritten, in the lobby of the theater, and audiences just poured over these beautiful letters talking about what Fidelio means to them, what collaborating on this project has meant to them. And so I think it really gave voice, literally, to these incarcerated folks who are so often invisible in American society. And it gave them an opportunity to participate in something larger than themselves and something that became a national and, I dare to say, international movement.
Am I right that Heartbeat Opera is continuing this? This is now a part of your programming?
Well, yes. So in 2020, we were really excited to remount this production and take it on tour. Then the pandemic hit, and then George Floyd was murdered, and we decided, okay, we want to keep working on Fidelio, but we also want to deepen the work, expand the work. And so we created a project called Breathing Free, a visual album, which features excerpts from Fidelio, including the Prisoner's Chorus, with songs by Black composers and lyricists like Langston Hughes, Harry T. Burley, Florence Price, Anthony Davis, and Thulani Davis, and also Negro spirituals. And so that was our most recent virtual project. We created a 45-minute opera film and had the chance to share that online, and we're continuing to share that currently.
And every performance was followed by a panel discussion with a range of topics and a range of voices. I'm curious what feedback you got about that, what you learned from that, and yeah, how that deepened that experience of this wonderful music. And also, we have to give a shout out to the dancers.
Yes, absolutely.
Because it was beautifully choreographed as well.
Yes, absolutely. Big shout out to our dancers, to our movement team, to our filmmaking team led by Ani Sisko, our filmmaker. You know, back in 2018, we hosted a conversation, a post-show conversation about carceral justice and arts in prisons. And that was really Heartbeat's first venture into that civic social justice space and holding space for community conversation. And we did that again when we remounted Fidelio a few months later, and it affected how we held future talkbacks. And so when our creative producer for Breathing Free, Roz Dia, was strategizing about how to share the film, he brilliantly came up with this series of six post-screening, you know, live virtual conversations with really amazing panelists. So we talked about arts in prisons. We talked about loving radically through legislation and, you know, in community. We talked about Black queer revolution, both in Fidelio and Breathing Free and beyond. We talked about decolonizing opera. And it was just a powerful series, you know, over the course of six nights to hold space for so many amazing Black artists, scholars, activists, you know, and other BIPOC folks, other white folks coming together to respond to Breathing Free and riff on it and talk about their work. And again, I think it was this reminder that, okay, opera can be current and connected to social impact and moving our culture forward.
Well, Ethan, you yourself are Chinese American, and certainly Asian roles have typically been created on stage through a filter of Orientalism. And it's from a viewpoint that is relentlessly European. And you talked a little bit about Butterfly. Talk about how you've rethought this.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I feel like I'm still learning so much about myself, my family heritage, and learning how to step into a more powerful presence in the arts community as a Chinese American. Butterfly was certainly a part of that journey for me, in that I was aware that the opera community was starting to deal with blackface, or ideally, you know, had removed blackface from productions of Verdi's Othello. You know, I think it's still problematic in terms of Aida. But I was very much aware that many, many non-Asian singers were playing Chojo-san, Suzuki, you know, and other roles in Butterfly. And I just wanted to talk about that and problematize that is yellowface in a way, and that Puccini's masterpiece is really, truly gorgeous and has integrity and great beauty and truth in it, and is deeply problematic and exoticizing of this submissive Asian woman kind of fetish and stereotype. And I wanted to look at that the impact of that story and that masterpiece really on me and on Asian Americans and on Asian women. And it's an ongoing conversation for sure, especially now.
Yeah, exactly. I love Puccini. this is highly problematic. Both things are true simultaneously. And I think that's the thing that one needs to work through. And, you know, you don't want to dismiss it because it's problematic, but you don't want to ignore the fact that it's really, really, really problematic either.
Exactly. And I think you can honor your artists and your audience by wrestling with the problems and talking about them and not sweeping them under the rug or suggesting that we should just continue as normal.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Okay, let's talk about the practicality of things. Where do you get money from?
Well, we'll be applying to the NEA soon. you know, we've been really fortunate in having a devoted group of donors stick with us. And we've been able to grow that group over the years. We really did start with a $10,000 Kickstarter back in 2014. And, you know, now we're about at a $500,000 annual budget. We really, you know, cultivate hopefully authentic relationships with our supporters. And actually, this Zoom year, as you might call it, has been a kind of beautiful way to actually connect with our supporters face to face on Zoom in a different way. You know, there is this sort of democracy of Zoom where everyone has a box. And compared to our interactions in theater lobbies in person, where we might have a brief interaction with a small portion of our audience, on Zoom, we actually did see hundreds and hundreds of people over the course of, we did 32 virtual soirees of Our Lady M, and, you know, have had other soirees and other gatherings since then. So that's a brief answer to the funding question. I mean, I guess there's also been the Eric Holder Initiative for Civil and Political Rights at Columbia University is supporting Fidelia on Breathing Free. And we're getting into the foundation world now.
We've mentioned this pandemic. How else has Heartbeat Opera sort of dealt with this COVID year? Because you haven't paused. You've kept on producing work.
We really did. You know, back in March, Dan and I had been planning a trip to visit our prison choirs, actually, to refilm the Prisoner's Chorus with folks. And we had to cancel that trip. And then we were planning on rehearsing our adaptation of Verdi's Macbeth called Lady M. And we decided to pivot that online. So we went back to our singers and instrumentalists and said, we can't do that in-person version, but we'd like to do a 10-day remote residency where we meet with you for 2 hours per day on Zoom. And then in the afternoon and evenings, you'll have creative homework assignments that included video projects, audio recordings, even photography projects. And it was a way of like starting our exploration of that piece. And we eventually called it an online Fantasia. And we had a music video, which we called Maladetta, of Lady M's sleepwalking scene. And we recorded a few other excerpts. And that was, you know, a joyful, invigorating month. And we found that there was a big audience and a hunger to gather on Zoom and share this virtual opera making. So that was a big, fun jumping off point in May and June of last year. Then we started planning Breathing Free. And actually now we're heading back to in-person performance. We are going to be at PS21 in Chatham, New York for another residency, which will culminate in two in-person semi-staged presentations of a brand new opera called The Extinctionist, composed by our co-music director, Daniel Schlossberg, with a libretto by Amanda Quaid, directed by Louisa Prosky. And we'll be live streaming those as well. But that's our first venture back to in-person performance.
My God, that must be so exciting.
It really is, yeah.
Oof. I want to go back to Lady M for a second. In your Fantasia, you collapse the fourth wall in the sense that we saw the rehearsals. We heard what went into the making of this. You know, we heard a phone call from the unemployment office that a singer received. Another artist stepped on her dog. Somebody else was dealing with her child. And collapsing that fourth wall has always been so important to Heartbeat as a company, that this is art created and performed by people for people. And I want you to just take me more into your thinking about that and why that's just so fundamental to you.
Oh, I love that question. You know, I think it's sort of instinctive, actually, but we knew that making Lady M was very unusual, and it was historic, and it was challenging, very challenging, but also hopefully uplifting to folks. And so I think just we wanted to share that process with our community and our audience, because we didn't feel like they could appreciate a finished, edited music video without understanding how it was made during quarantine. Because as you know, the seven instrumentalists were recording at home separately in their own closets.
Which is amazing.
And then an editor was editing all those tracks together. Same with the voices. And in terms of video, at that point, Heartbeat was just asking our singers to use their own smartphones and film themselves and have their loved ones and their housemates film them. So that behind the scenes making of story seemed like a really important layer. And actually we definitely confirmed, you know, with our audiences that they were thrilled to be invited into that process.
Oh yeah, I was. I loved it. I love process. So yeah. I was just at the edge of my seat the whole time. It was great. Ethan, how did you come to opera?
Well, I grew up in DC and I loved singing as a boy, and had the great opportunity to be in Christmas Revels for 7 years and sing in the Washington National Opera. I did, you know, many, many musicals and plays growing up, went to Interlochen Arts Camp. It was, I was bit by the bug very early.
And what attracted you to opera specifically?
Well, I think there's definitely this, just the superhuman talent and virtuosity of opera singing. I really marvel at that, and the beauty of that. I love the canvas. You know, as a director, I love that opera is this coming together of all of the performing arts and the visual arts as well. And there's a kind of expressivity and flexibility that I find in opera, especially with these classics where directors can play around a little bit more. So I think I was attracted to that playground that opera offers.
It's hard to imagine a more collaborative art form than opera.
True.
And yeah. I would just love for you to talk to me about what these collaborations give you as a creator, as an artist.
You know, I think ensemble, company, community are really important to me. And I love leading a group of folks and sort of rallying them, building the team, and trying to make something together that we can all love and be a part of. And as you said, you know, opera can be sometimes the most challenging of collaborations, because you've got the orchestra and you've got the backstage and the singers and the dancers and the tech and the design. And it's really miraculous when it all comes together. And it is, to me, an embodiment of civilization and like what humanity is capable of. And as I mature as just a person and an artist, I realize more and more that for me, art in society and what my mission is as an artist is to foster love and to create works of love and beauty. And opera is a beautiful channel for that.
You know, the performing arts, I'm not telling you anything you don't know, they've suffered so much during the pandemic. And yet, ironically, for many of us, it's the arts that have seen us through the pandemic.
Indeed.
And you mentioned that you're going to Chatham, New York for a virtual and live performance. But I would imagine audiences will be limited, and that affects the bottom line for all companies, but especially for a company that is small like yours.
Right.
And so I'm assuming that after a year of pandemic, you're rethinking performance space. You're beginning to get a sense of what might be changing, how it might be different.
Yeah, there's a big, steep, challenging climb ahead, I think, for all performing arts organizations and definitely for Heartbeat. I'm hopeful, but I do feel daunted by the coming months because, you know, we're not out of the tunnel. We don't know what coming back into a theater will be like. We don't know how many tickets we can sell. We don't know if these variants will hit us hard in some unexpected way. So, you know, Heartbeat is, we're trying to make plans. We're trying to sketch out future productions, future touring even. We have some good ideas and good plans in place, but, you know, I don't think the performing arts is going to be back to normal for a while. And on top of that, Heartbeat is very much looking at equity, diversity, inclusion, and anti-racism efforts and really dedicating ourselves to making some really important systemic changes. And that takes resources, you know, time, energy, money to do that well.
Pandemic aside, because no one could have imagined that, I'm wondering where you find yourself now, 7 years later, that you just could never have imagined 7 years ago.
Well, yeah, pandemic aside.
Pandemic aside, because that, of course, would be the answer.
Oh my gosh. Well, we always dreamt of, you know, performing at BAM or touring. And now we actually are going to have those opportunities. You know, we got to do this co-production with Opera Lafayette, which allowed us to go to BAM. The Broad Stage in Santa Monica, the Mondavi Center at UC Davis, they want to host Fidelio in person in the future. Breathing Free screenings are reaching all over the country and the world. You know, Dan and I were invited to Paris to speak in a symposium about Fidelio, and that work is being published in a book. So the reach of Heartbeat's work is really exciting. And I'm so thrilled that's happened in 7 years. So we'll see, you know, what comes next.
Well, I can't wait to see what you're going to do next. When I think of this pandemic year, discovering Heartbeat Opera has been really one of the gifts I've been given.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My pleasure speaking with you.
That was co-artistic director of Heartbeat Opera, Ethan Hurd. You can find out more about the company and their productions at heartbeatopera.org. You've been listening to Artworks, produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Josephine Reed. Stay safe, and thanks for listening.